This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember that famous 1993 photo of a dead American soldier being dragged through a street in Mogadishu, Somalia, by a mob that danced and cheered while beating the corpse? That picture was taken by my guest, Paul Watson. Although he won a Pulitzer Prize for the photo, the picture and its afterlife still haunt him. Watson has been covering wars and hotspots for nearly two decades. He won a George Polk Award for his reporting in Kosovo, and this year he won an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting on Afghanistan. He's currently Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Watson formerly worked for the Toronto Star. His new memoir about covering war is called Where War Lives. Paul Watson, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a description of the famous Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph that you took.
This is in the streets of Mogadishu on October 4th, 1993, at the end of a 16-hour battle which started on October 3rd between U.S. Army Rangers, Delta Force, Special Forces, and Somali militias. You know, it was an arrest operation trying to snatch senior commanders, leaders in Mohammed Faraidid's militia because they were trying to get to him and arrest him for allegedly organizing attacks on UN peacekeepers. The morning that we woke up after this long battle with, you know, clouds of smoke swirling and hundreds of Somali corpses in the streets, we immediately heard rumors that there was an American soldier that had been captured and was being paraded through the city. Some days prior to this incident, there had been a similar incident, but Somalis had paraded pieces of an American soldier. I'd photographed that, and the Pentagon had denied it. When I heard on this morning that there was a body being paraded, perhaps live, perhaps dead, I was determined to go and get a photograph of it.
Describe the photo.
We had been searching for an hour, 2 hours. I can't remember exactly what it was, and we'd almost given up, because we'd literally gone street corner to street corner through this battle zone asking passersby if they had seen the body. And they would just point and direct us. And we still couldn't find it. We were close to giving up and just going back to the hotel when the driver on his own made a U-turn because he had seen a small group of people on a side street going down a slight incline. And this was the group that was dragging Staff Sergeant William David Cleveland's body through the streets. I had worked with this crew that was, you know, driver, gunman, as a bodyguard, and a translator, and an extra gunman on that day. I'd worked with them for, you know, over periods of weeks and months, over several years. So we really worked well as a unit. The translator jumped out of the car, explained who I was, and I was pretty identifiable in Mogadishu because I'd been there a long time. And he said he just wants to take some pictures. The crowd parted and I came out of the car and did that.
You know, you write in your book, the mob danced and cheered and beat Cleveland's corpse with such gusto. It seemed that their blood-addled minds weren't simply desecrating the body of one fallen soldier, but stomping on a whole defeated army. What was it like for you to be in the middle of that mob, knowing you were an American too, and had they been more aware of you, they might have turned on you as well.
I was terrified, but at the same time, determined to get that picture. And it's really hard to describe the state that you go into in a moment like that. It's cliche to talk about out-of-body experiences, but it really did feel like I was watching somebody else do it. And when you have a camera in front of your eye, and you're focusing so intently to get a sharp, good image, you tend to shut out anything that's peripheral. And at that moment, even though there was the noise of the crowd and the helicopters and various other things going on in the city, everything went completely silent. And I felt almost what I can only describe as immediate contact with that dead soldier. You know, almost a conversation.
What was the conversation?
Well, I heard a voice very distinctly. I've sought psychiatric help in subsequent years, and my psychiatrist said it was my superego. I believe it was William David Cleveland's voice. And he said, as clearly as something inside your head and outside at the same time, if you do this, I will own you forever. And then I tried, without opening my mouth, I tried to say, forgive me, but understand why I have to do this. And any of the soldiers who knew how fast this mission was going wrong would understand only from those words what I meant.
What did that voice mean to you? How did it interpret it? How did you interpret it when you heard his voice saying, if you do this, I will own you forever?
I took it as a warning, and I actually, you know, the response that I thought was just understand that I have to do this. I don't have a choice. I don't want to do this. I don't want to participate in your desecration, because that's what I did. I mean, if someone hadn't photographed what those Somalis were doing, obviously it would have been real, it would have happened, but it would have been kept on the streets of Mogadishu. By photographing it, it became a global image. It became a repetitive abuse of a man's body. And, you know, I've done a lot of reading after this to try and understand if this is a religious thing or if there's some taboo that we learn about not desecrating bodies. But I'm convinced that there's something deeply innate in the human psyche, no matter religion, creed, culture, that says this is wrong. We all know not to do that. And yet, I had to photograph what they were doing in order to tell the truth, because the truth was being denied by the Pentagon.
What did the photograph actually show? Describe it.
Staff Sergeant Cleveland had been stripped of his clothes. He was wearing green Army-issue underwear and was naked, but for that. His arms were bound at the wrist, and there was at least one rope around one of his ankles. He had numerous bullet wounds, and I remember very distinctly noticing as they flipped him back and forth that he was limp. And I thought to myself, you know, could he possibly still be alive, because rigor mortis hasn't set in? And I, you know, these thoughts are going through one's head, obviously, rapid fire. But I was, you know, I was seeing those minute details while at the same time trying to get enough photographs. And in this instance, we're talking about, I think, 3 or 4 frames before my guards pulled me away and back into the car for my own safety.
Okay, so you had just like a few seconds really to take these shots.
That's right.
Were you thinking like, how am I going to frame this? What is the emphasis going to be on? The body, the mob, a little bit of both? Or did you just like snap it without even thinking what you were framing?
No, you know, I was actually thinking, because and this is an interesting part of the story. The first shots I took are full body pictures, and there's an old man to one side who has his cane in full swing, clubbing the Cleveland's corpse with his cane, and then people are dancing around him. My bodyguards pulled me away because they heard people saying things in the crowd which they took as death threats. And in those frames, it's rather happy, jubilant faces. When they pulled me back into the car, I was sitting right next to the right passenger door with 2 bodyguards next to me in the back seat. I immediately thought that and pardon me for being somewhat graphic, the image showed the underwear slightly askew. So part of the corpse's genitals were exposed, a very small part. But I knew from having worked with photographers on other stories that that's the kind of thing a newspaper wouldn't print. The violence was perhaps going to be acceptable, but the exposure of sex organs wouldn't be. So the driver was waiting for the crowd to move off, and it moved off around a corner to the left. I immediately popped open the door and jumped back out, ran around the front of the car, and then the crowd stopped And then I took a half-body photograph, which is the one that most people would recognize.
Once you took the photos, you had to get them out of the country back to... who did you have to send them back to?
My first stop was back to the hotel, where I basically collapsed, both hating myself for what I had done and also wondering who the hell I thought I was. I literally collapsed in, sobbing on a bed in my hotel room. After stuffing, I took the film out and stuffed it under the mattress. I was sort of berating myself for having taken a risk that was extreme, because at that moment, the significance of what I'd done really hadn't sunk in. I didn't know whether anyone would print the pictures, and I had a pretty strong feeling that they wouldn't.
But they did. The Associated Press printed it, and so did Time Magazine. But they each did differently. Why don't you describe the difference?
AP moved the half-body shots, which appeared in newspapers across America, because there was long debate by many newspaper editors about whether these were acceptable or not. But most, and I've spoken to some of them in subsequent years, decided that they had no choice, that it just was too significant not to print. What Time Magazine did, which is intriguing to me, is they digitally altered the underwear so that when you look at the full-page photograph in Time Magazine, you don't see any genitals exposed. But you do see horrific desecration of an American corpse.
My guest is journalist Paul Watson. His new memoir is called Where War Lives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Paul Watson. His new memoir about reporting from war zones is called Where War Lives. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1993 photo of a mob desecrating the corpse of an American soldier in Somalia. This photograph had incredible impact. Tell us some of the greatest impact you think the photo had.
I'm torn by this because this is where what you were describing earlier, the sense of accomplishment, sank in. I heard only through a New York Newsday reporter who phoned on the satellite phone that night or the next to interview me about the picture. I had no idea whether it had been used anywhere. He quickly caught on to that and asked me, said to me, you really don't know the impact this picture's having, do you? And I said, no, I have no idea. He explained to me that there was a political firestorm, that, the heat was immediately on President Clinton and his administration to do something. His choice was to announce the immediate end to the mission to arrest Idid and to promise that American troops would be withdrawn. Now, because of the political impact of the events in Somalia, when it came time to decide whether the United States should lead an intervention into Rwanda to save up to 800,000 people who were killed in 100 days, your listeners will know that the administration decided not only not to intervene, but not to use the word genocide so that they would not be forced to intervene. And that's directly related, I'm afraid, to that photograph.
How?
Well, Clinton clearly had been burned once by an intervention in Africa. He didn't want it to happen twice. And, there are any number of experts who would tell you that they're two completely different situations. For instance, we now know without doubt that al-Qaeda was involved in the events of October 3rd, 4th in Mogadishu. It's listed in indictments in U.S. federal court. Bin Laden has bragged about it. His deputies have bragged about it. I've other evidence which is in the book. It was a completely different battle that was being fought there. The second thing which disturbs me more is I get the sense that al-Qaeda learned a lot from the propaganda impact of that picture. Only 18 soldiers were killed on that day. you know, it's nothing compared to what would happen on a bad day in Vietnam, and it's only relatively, you know, bad compared to what's happening frequently now in Iraq. The difference is it had an enormous multiply, you know, it was amplified enormously because there was a photograph of it.
What you're saying is it was used in a way as a tool by al-Qaeda to exaggerate the power of the opposition to America.
That's right. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, take all the events that happened and then remove the photograph, and al-Qaeda would not have chased American forces out of Somalia. Bin Laden would not have been able to tell his followers, we're able to do this. We only need small victories to defeat history's greatest military. Enter the picture, and they are able to do that.
So does all this make you think that you wish you hadn't taken the photograph? The photograph that you won the Pulitzer Prize for?
I'm still glad I did it because, to me, the blame lies with the people who refuse to accept the truth. And this is a crucially important point.
Which people are you referring to?
Well, on September 18th, I believe it was, a Black Hawk, this, you know, we're going back a couple of weeks before the October incident.
And this is 1993, yeah.
That's right. A Black Hawk was shot down. I went to the scene. There was a burnt out wreckage, and Somalis were parading bits of burnt flesh and teeth. I photographed it. It went out on the wires. I reported it on CNN because they saw a Reuters story quoting me and phoned. And then the Pentagon immediately reacted and said there is no basis in fact for reports that American body parts are being paraded through the streets of Mogadishu. If they had accepted at that point the truth, quite possibly October 3rd and 4th would never have happened. Staff Sergeant William David Cleveland would still be alive. Bin Laden would not have had a propaganda victory. So to me, the fault lies in cynical manipulation of the truth rather than my effort to pin the truth down.
Now, here's a kind of bizarre effect of your photograph. Idid, who was like the chief warlord opposing the United States in Somalia, sent you a thank you message because your photo helped inspire Clinton to stop the effort in Somalia. So Idid sent you a thank you message and invited you for dinner, and you figured you'd accept and interview him. What was the dinner like?
You know, just hearing you say that, the shame just washes over me. I should have just said no thanks, but I was intrigued because I wanted to get an answer, really, to one question. I don't even remember the dinner. It was me sitting alone with him, with one of his close aides. I don't remember if I even ate, because there was one question rolling over in my mind constantly. During the arrest operation, I had gone to in earlier days, during the arrest mission, I'd gone to the house of a man named Osman Atto, who was Idid's bagman and arms supplier, and possibly was working for the CIA, many people thought, playing both sides. He had been snatched and taken off to an island, you know, somewhere in the Indian Ocean, I think, and I was going through his house with a colleague, trying to see if we could find any interesting things. And as we left the house, a beat-up small car pulled up in front of the gate, and it was packed full of women. And I just took a peek sort of into the rear window as I walked past, and it was, of course, surrounded by gunmen. And I saw a man, bald-headed man, sitting, you know, slouched down in between these women in the back seat. And immediately the guards started screaming at me. And as I walked away, I really thought they were going to shoot me in the back. I didn't have long enough to look to know that it was Idid, but I suspected it was. And that's what I wanted to ask him at dinner. So I did, finally, when he finished talking. And he smiled and said, yeah, that was me.
You felt so bad about taking this photograph of the mob dragging the dead soldier through the streets of Somalia because you felt like you were participating in the desecration by creating a public image of it that would be seen around the world. You felt so bad years later, you tried to apologize to the family. Do you think that the photograph made things worse for the family of the dead soldier?
I've no doubt about that. I actually tried to see his mother. This is about 10 years after. And I was not able to speak to her directly. Her son responded to my... I'd left a message on her voicemail. And the sense of anger in his voice was really quite disheartening. I had this sort of fantasy that they would welcome me into their home and we could, you know, sort of cry on each other's shoulder and reach some sort of reconciliation. But they wanted nothing to do with it.
Paul Watson will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called Where War Lives. He's now the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for the LA Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Paul Watson. His new memoir, Where War Lives, is about covering wars. This year, he won an Overseas Press Club Award for his coverage of Afghanistan, and he won a George Polk Award for his coverage of Kosovo, but he's best known for the Pulitzer Prize-winning photo he took in 1993 on a street in Mogadishu while a mob desecrated the corpse of an American soldier. Given all of the personal and global repercussions of your photograph of the mob dragging the body of the American soldier through the streets of Somalia, were there photographs that you later decided not to shoot because you were worried about what the consequences would be?
Yes, there was an incident soon after the October 4th picture when things had settled down a fair bit. And, you know, all these events are taking place in South Mogadishu, a divided city. In North Mogadishu, commanded by a different warlord, Islamic courts had just started setting up. And your listeners will know that in recent years, those Islamic courts, which some, certainly in the American administration, believe are affiliated with al-Qaeda, have become a much more significant problem. They were in the early stages in those days. I was invited through my translator to come and witness the first stoning to death of a man found guilty of rape by one of these Islamic courts. And so we made our way across the green line into this other zone. And I immediately, when we showed up for the court proceeding to begin, the guy in charge said he doesn't have his camera. And the translator translated all this, and he said, you know, they'll hold the trial for you to go back and get your camera. And I said, if they want me to take pictures of this, I'm not going to do it.
Why, if they want you, wouldn't you do it?
Well, it just was obvious that they wanted propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to photograph the execution by stoning of a man simply to feed the propaganda interests of an Islamic court. You know, if you ask about regret, I regret that I didn't take the picture.
Why?
Well, after the story appeared, I got a phone call from... I was back in South Africa at this point. I got a phone call from London from a woman at Amnesty International. And she said, you know, this is really a stunning story you've written, you know, half implying that it sounds a little fantastical. Do you have any photographs? And I said no, and I explained, just as I have now, why I didn't have photographs. And she, you know, well, said thanks very much and hung up. The truth is, there's so much deception and fabrication out there that if you don't have photographic evidence of it, people just won't believe it. And, you know, to have photographs of a brutal event like that would tell people a lot about the Islamic courts movement in Somalia.
My guest is journalist Paul Watson, and he's now based in Indonesia for the LA Times. He received a Pulitzer Prize for his 1993 photo of a Somali mob dragging an American soldier's corpse through the streets. He also received a George Polk Award for his reporting from Kosovo. You know, we've been talking about the repercussions of your photo of the American soldier's body being dragged through the streets of Somalia. You were attacked by a mob yourself in Iraq. What happened?
This is in the early stages of the conflict, soon after, I think either the day of or the day after the entry by U.S. Marines into the city of Tikrit. I was in Mosul, to the north of that, and most of the reporters had gone down to Tikrit. I was simply driving around in Mosul trying to find a story that day, and we happened upon a large demonstration in front of the governor's building. We got out of the car. I was working with a fresh translator because I'd lost two or three who had quit before this because they didn't like the risks I was taking. And so I was trying to break them in a little and thought that this was just a noisy protest. Within minutes of arriving at this thing, we saw a French TV vehicle speeding through the mob, being stoned, and almost getting stopped, and the crew pulled out, but they managed to get away. And then as this mob of several thousand people was pressing closer to the governor's building, U.S. forces, Marines and others, were firing heavy weapons, machine guns, assault rifles, and such, into the crowd to keep them back. I was quickly taking photographs, and I had what I thought was a pretty good one. It was a boy, maybe seven, eight years old, who was running right up to a Marine vehicle with a 50 caliber machine gun on the back that pounds like a jackhammer, and throwing rocks at it. And it looked like something from the West Bank, except it's U.S. troops firing at close range and not Israelis. And I'm the only person on the scene for this. And remember, most of the images at the time were celebrating Iraqis. And here I had what I thought was much closer to what was going to be the truth about Iraq, Iraqis attacking U.S. forces and being shot. As I was taking these photographs, a small group of people carrying a wounded man came past me trying to run to get him medical care. And he had a deep gash from a bullet wound straight across his forehead and across the top of his head. And someone in that group that was carrying him saw me with cameras, stopped, and made a clicking motion as if to say, take a picture. I had a long lens. I had two cameras. One camera with the batteries had gone down. I had to switch a long lens to a shorter lens to get the photograph because they were so close to me. When I had the lens between my knees, moving them back and forth, this small group of men suddenly realized, hey, what's this foreigner doing among us? And then they were upon me. Before I knew it, there were about 300, I was riding on a sea of about 300 people who were kicking at my back, punching me, stoning me. They stripped me of my cameras, and then they got me down onto the ground and continued to stone me and pummel me. And I because I had seen other people killed in this way in other countries, I pretty much thought that was it.
How did you manage to survive?
Well, I sound like a bleeding heart, but the truth of these places always turns out to be the same. Good Iraqi people, not knowing who I was, I could have been a CIA spy, I could have been any enemy element, they risked their lives to save mine. They immediately formed a circle. It would have been about a dozen people. So about a dozen people against a crowd of 300 pressing in. And, after all, these 12 were part of that crowd in the first place. They formed a circle around me and tried to push the crowd back. And we were close to a row of shops, all of which had shuttered down because of the protest. There was one open, which was a tea shop. And as we moved along, with the mob pounding against these metal shutters, the tea shop tried to close theirs because they thought the whole place was going to be torn apart. These guys try to save me, and there are men with homemade knives that were about a foot long of rusty steel trying to come over the top of the circle of men defending me. As all this is happening, they're pulling the shutter back up and got it up about a foot, foot and a half, and then shoved me under it.
So you were protected in the tea shop?
Right. I got into the tea shop, but then the mob tried to rip this metal shutter off the front of the store. A man went up to the roof with an AK-47 and fired down into the crowd. And then the shop owner said, look, I'd really, really like to help you, but would you mind leaving my shop? So we ended up going out into the middle of the street and bowed down at the order of the Marines with our hands up, and they eventually were persuaded to let us into the compound.
Is death by mob attack the most frightening form of attack you can think of while covering war?
It is. To this day, crowds scare me to death. And for a simple reason. I think it would be poetic justice for me to get torn apart by a mob.
When you say poetic justice, you mean because you captured that photo of the mob in Somalia dragging the body of the American soldier and felt like you had somehow participated in his desecration by taking the picture?
That's right. I've always had this sense that Cleveland is, remember, if you do this, I will own you forever. I just get this sense that he may be waiting and watching. I certainly had it at that moment here's how it ends. I watched your desecration. Now here comes mine. That's what I thought.
So would you never, for instance, like go to a stadium concert or a sports arena because of this fear of crowds?
I might go to a sports arena, but I really tend to be solitary. I stick to my family, my wife, my son, because I was treated by a psychiatrist for post-traumatic stress disorder and chronic depression years before this incident. And actually after this incident. And it's the cumulative effect of all of that that just makes me, all sense of trust has vanished. So I find it very difficult to be among people in, ordinary social events, dinner parties, that kind of thing. I tend to stay away.
My guest is journalist Paul Watson. His new memoir is called Where War Lives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Paul Watson. He's now based in Indonesia for the LA Times. His new memoir is called Where War Lives. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1993 photo, a very famous photo of a Somali mob dragging a dead American soldier through the streets. He won a George Polk Award for his reporting from Kosovo. You think that your photo of the Somali mob and, dragging the American soldier's body through the streets helped stop the Clinton administration from intervening in Rwanda to stop the genocide, and you were in Rwanda covering the genocide. I want to ask you about something you write about Rwanda, and I should mention here you saw horrible things. Like one example, you write that at one church in Rwanda and in its small Catholic school, you walked among as many as 1,000 corpses. You also write that one day, standing on a bridge on Rwanda's border with Tanzania, you lit up a joint and got high as you watched the evidence of genocide spill across the border. And when I read that, I thought, there were certain kinds of highs I would imagine would make the horror much, much more vivid, much worse. So I guess, as I read that, I was really wondering, why would you get high then, and how does it change the way the whole experience registers on you?
At that part of my life, I was really on a fast-moving treadmill, going from killing in the townships of Johannesburg and elsewhere in South Africa, up to Somalia, and then down to Rwanda, and it was endless. And the only way I could deal with it was to self-medicate. So I would drink myself to sleep at night, and I would smoke dope during the day. And I only know it now because I'm I'm clean and sober, and I, you know, I'm much more responsible in the way I work. But as I was going through it then, I was on autopilot, really, and I was clear thinking. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't wandering around in a fog, but the only way I could deal with it was to try to smooth the edges off every day. You know, I think ordinary people would understand this. If you have one shocking event in your life, it takes a long time to get over it. Imagine if you're having shocking events day after day after day. The only way you can get through that, seems to me, is to you know, smooth out the edges, self-medicate.
I'm thinking of what a weird experience it must have been. You were covering Rwanda, and you think that America's reluctance to intervene in Rwanda had to do in part with the horrors that you showed through your photograph of the Somali mob dragging the American soldier's body through the street. And in Rwanda, you find out you won the Pulitzer Prize for that photograph from Somalia, and you fly from Rwanda to New York to accept the prize. I'm just thinking, like, I don't know, does it get more surreal than that?
Right. And I mean, that was also part of the treadmill. I remember the feeling distinctly. I was, you know, I picked up a jacket and some trousers at the Brooks Brothers, and they didn't fit particularly well. And I had shoes that were new that also didn't fit, and I didn't really felt like I belonged in that scene. And I was with a big boss from the newspaper eating canapes, and all I wanted to, you know, the only place I really wanted to be was back in Africa.
Now, you've talked about how you've suffered with chronic depression and went through a period of, like, self-medicating while you were covering wars. Do you think that the depression is a result of being exposed to atrocities all the time during your war reporting? Or do you think that maybe because of chronic depression, you put yourself in the position of covering wars where your life would always be on the line and everything would be in extreme all the time?
Yeah, I think you've got it exactly right in the latter. One of the reasons I wanted to write this book is that it seemed to me that the wars in human hearts are just as important and are certainly connected to the larger wars we watch on our TVs. In the course of writing this book, I wanted to go back as a journalist to make sure that I had scenes accurately, I had remembered events accurately, and I ended up interviewing the translators and, you know, other people I'd worked alongside in different countries. I went back to the psychiatrist, he went through his notes, that sort of thing. And strangely enough, as we discussed the project I was working on, they started to open up themselves. And in each case, they started to tell me their own stories of their own inner wars. And that led to the title, Where War Lives, which quotes Albert Camus, who, you know, the Algerian-French philosopher, journalist, writer, who at the start of the Second World War, as he's writing in his notebooks, says, "I've found the answer to the question, where does war live? It lives in all of us." And to me, that's the point.
You know, you quote Brendan Behan. Each of your chapters has a terrific quote to kick it off. And one of the chapters starts with this quote from Brendan Behan: "A bit of shooting takes your mind off your troubles. It makes you forget the cost of living." Hmm. So getting back to suffering with chronic depression before becoming a war correspondent, do you think that that's part of it, that, you know, that war takes your mind off your own inner war?
Yeah, and, you know, there's probably an even better one in my situation. I'm quoted in there, you know, men start wars because, you know, it helps make sure that women don't laugh at them. you know,
the... how do you interpret that?
Well, in my case, it made me feel bigger than I really am.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it doesn't take a lot to put your life on the line and take pictures or write stories. All you have to be willing to do is to die. The rewards are huge. People think you're courageous and heroic and all those things, which you really aren't. You're more sick than anything, in my opinion. So the payback is big. And each time you get away with it, you think, wow, I'm pretty cool. I'm better than everybody else because I can get away with this. When in fact, you're simply lucky. Lucky that you're not dead, and unlucky that you're suffering a mental illness.
Are you saying being a war correspondent is a form of mental illness?
I think it is. I've spent enough time around people who do this a lot. In my opinion, and I include myself foremost in this group, it's a lot of misfits, people who are seeking self-esteem through risk. The standard question is, why do you do this? And the standard answer usually is in pursuit of the truth. Well, anyone who's done this for any length of time doesn't have to think very hard to see that the truth is really not getting out. The amount of obfuscation and deception that's carried out by militaries, governments, that we're trying to cut through is so enormous that the work a war correspondent does, you know, it may shine a little light, but I really don't think that we're knights on white horses, that's for sure.
My guest is journalist Paul Watson. His new memoir is called Where War Lives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Paul Watson. His new memoir about reporting from war zones is called Where War Lives. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1993 photo of a mob desecrating the corpse of an American soldier in Somalia. You know, at the same time that you talk about your chronic depression and why you put yourself at risk to cover war and genocide, you now have a kidney problem. How do you handle the risk that your own body is putting before you compared to the risk that you willingly take when you go to a war zone?
It's funny. I said to someone the other day that it wasn't really the other day. It was some weeks back in Afghanistan. Who was talking about some risk that we shouldn't take, and I said, "Don't worry about it. I'm already dead." And really I have that sense that I've lived longer than I should have, so if my kidneys give out, no big deal.
So you're not a worrier about your body in that respect?
Not really. I mean, I want to live because I want to see my son grow up and be happy, but I know that I'm going to die, so if it's tomorrow, it's really no big deal. I really have a sense that I've lived much longer than I should have in the first place.
So does that mean like you're putting yourself at even greater risk now because you figure, what the heck?
No. I'm more reluctant. I still will do it in situations where I think there's a truth that has to be told. And I don't mean that in a normal sense. I mean it more in the sense of I'm just sick of being lied to. And I take it as a personal challenge to make sure nobody's lying to me, which simply means going out and looking for myself. I continue to do it, but with financial pressures on newspapers and people talking about the bottom line and all that sort of thing, it's very clear in my mind that bleeding out on the side of the road in, southern Philippines, and leaving my son fatherless for the rest of his life would be a pretty silly thing to do, given the reality of the industry I work in.
We haven't talked about the fact that you were born with one hand. Do you have a prosthetic that you use on your handless arm?
I used to, but it was too hot and bulky, and just it didn't do enough to justify the weight and heat. So I wear nothing. I have so it's a shorter arm with a small wrist and a very small palm.
How do you think it's affected the decisions you've made about risk in your life to be someone who is probably seen by a lot of people as being more vulnerable because you lack a hand and a full arm?
We know it's helped me a lot because, for instance, guerrilla fighters think I'm a wounded war veteran. So it gets you a little street credibility, you know, which I wouldn't normally deserve. And in the Iraq incident I was describing, when that small group of men were risking their lives to save mine.
To save you from the mob.
That's right. One of them actually raised my disabled left arm and shouted out in Arabic, because I had a tape recorder and I got someone to translate it later. He shouted out in Arabic, "He's innocent, he's innocent." And his evidence for my innocence was that I was disabled. So it has helped a lot. But more important, growing up in this condition forced me to understand and see through the eyes of the weak. So I relate to and I understand the position of the weak in the world. And I feel much more comfortable around those people than I do around the powerful.
What have you been focusing on in Jakarta, where you're based for the LA Times?
I've been trying to do lighter, more interesting stories, because, quite frankly, it's made clear to us that the public is really becoming tired because of the burden of what's going wrong in Iraq and such. I eventually, though, and this will happen soon, I expect, have to start dealing with another front in the war on terror, which is the southern Philippines, southern Thailand, which is really getting quite serious in recent weeks, where Al-Qaeda, some of them affiliated forces and others not affiliated, are increasingly, carrying out attacks and both of conventional against Philippine Thai forces and also terrorist attacks.
Paul Watson, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you very much. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Watson's new memoir about reporting from war zones is called Where War Lives. He's currently the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for the LA Times.